Welcome to the Black Tower Podcast, a Wheel of Time podcast. I'm Thorn.
And I'm Greg.
And today we're going to be talking about Robert Jordan's The Wheel of Time. Specifically, we're going to be talking about The Shadow Rising. The fourth book in The Wheel of Time? Is that right?
Okay, so Thorn, I'll have to stop you here. If you don't know the number of book that is, our listeners... If you stop listening now, I don't blame you. I'm terribly sorry for my associate, my co-host.
It is the fourth book.
Yes,
it's on the show notes.
Yes, she even has show notes, guys. But obviously, we are going to talk about The Shadow Rising tonight, the fourth book in Robert Jordan's The Wheel of Time. This is our book review. So, spoiler alert, I'm going to see if I can nail this better than Thorne's first attempt last week, but... We will be spoiling everything up to the end of The Shadow Rising. We will do our best to contain spoilers within the first four books. So if you have not read through the end of The Shadow Rising, please do not listen to this episode.
Yeah, that's a lot better than mine.
Well, you know, I was able to listen to your blooper. By the way, guys, if you didn't catch Thorne's blooper, go back to last week's episode and listen to the very end of the episode, and you will hear her attempt at winging it when it comes to the spoiler warning. So, Thorne, let's just get into it. So tell us a little bit of overarching information about The Shadow Rising.
Okay, so The Shadow Rising, of course, we know is... a fantasy novel by American author Robert Jordan, and it is the fourth book of The Wheel of Time.
So far, we're in the Wikipedia page. So far, that's what we're at the Wikipedia facts.
Yeah. It was published by Tor Books and released on September 15th of 1992.
I was 2 years old.
I wasn't born yet.
Wow. Am I that much older than you?
I was born in 93.
I was born in 90. I'm 29.
Yeah, so you're 3 years older than I am.
Oh, God, I'm old. Anyway.
The book has 393,823 words, and it is the longest book of The Wheel of Time, although it has fewer pages than Lord of Chaos.
Which is interesting to me because Shadow Rising and Lord of Chaos are two of my favorites. Actually, Shadow Rising is in a tie for my favorite Wheel of Time book with Towers of Midnight. And then Lord of Chaos comes in at a solid number two. So that is interesting for me, though, that two of my favorite Wheel of Time books are that close in comparison when it comes to their length.
Yeah. So, The Shadow Rising has 58 chapters, and it's the first book. It's the first book in the main sequence of The Wheel of Time that does not contain a prologue.
Oh, that's right. It didn't have a prologue, did it?
I guess not. I didn't get a chance to read it this week.
Yeah, I don't remember it having... You know what? I've actually got... No, it's that's absolutely correct. Starts out with chapter one, Seeds of Shadow, and goes through to chapter 58. I listened to the majority of the beginning of the books. Like, whenever I would get to a new book, I would be listening to it and not, like, opening it up and reading it. So the fact that it didn't have a prologue probably was lost on me because I was just starting a new book, and then it's either going to be Kate Redding or Michael Kramer coming on and doing the book, and I'm just like, I don't care what prologue it is or whatever. I'm just listening to the story. So now that I'm sitting here looking at a list of chapters, yes, it starts with chapter one. That's odd.
Yeah. So I've got a little bit of a point of view breakdown. I did not organize this well. So it looks like Perrin Ibarra has the majority of the point of view with 22.1%. And Randall Thor has 16.8%.
You know, at first I thought that was backwards, but I guess the more I think about it, I guess it makes more sense.
Yeah. And then you've got Elaine coming in for third place at 13.7%. I am rounding that up. And then everybody else seems to have, oh, well, Matt Coffin has 8.4%. And then everybody else seems to have less than 4% of the book.
With the exception of Egwene, looks like she's got 7.3, according to this.
Oh, I totally missed that. Yep, she has 7.36. Yeah.
For some reason, it's out four decimal places, but whatever.
All of them are. I didn't organize this well.
Yeah, you're spitting out which one's like the highest, and I'm like, where is that? Where is? Oh, it's halfway. It's halfway down the list. Why is it halfway down the list? If it's the top, I don't.
Because I got it off of Wikipedia, and I just wrote it down as it was written in Wikipedia, and I didn't get a chance to reorganize it to make sense.
You heard it here first, folks. We are not that organized.
Thorne uses Wikipedia.
Oh, no shame in Wikipedia. I'm just talking about the organization. Everything...
I think by now that they get that we're not very well organized.
Well, you listen to us anyway. So, just kind of a brief, I guess when I'm thinking of the Shadow Rising, if I had to pitch it to somebody or at least kind of tell someone where in the story I am, if I'm about to begin this book, last major thing that happened in the series, of course, at the end of The Dragon Reborn, you know, Ran is more thusly confirmed as a Dragon Reborn. He sees his Kalendor out of the Stone of Tyr, and, you know, all kind of epicness happening all around him. That was all completely broken down and discussed a few episodes ago in Thorne's first episode, actually. So if you guys want a breakdown of the events before this book, then just, you know, go a few episodes back and you'll be able to find it. But there was major turn in the series there. Whenever I'm compartmentalizing the parts of the series, you know, in my head, when I'm thinking about, you know, certain arcs and things, I always put a separation, the first separation in my head between Dragon Reborn and Shadow Rising, because everything does turn between, like, at the end of The Dragon Reborn and the beginning of Shadow Rising, and it definitely turns throughout Shadow Rising, and of course we're going to speak about that in a minute, but definitely the first three books wrapped up, all the introduction stuff kind of out of the way, all this mystery around Rand's destiny, now we know who he is the Dragon Reborn, and now he's about to set out really in this book to begin to fulfill that, and that's kind of where we pick up at the beginning of Shadow Rising.
Yes, and right at the beginning, we get an attack on the Stone of Tyr by Trollocs and Fades.
It's like the action doesn't even stop. So we had all the fighting and everything going on, and then, of course, his duel with the Forsaken in the Stone of Tyr, and then it's like they get to breathe, and then there is basically another round of attacks. And it's, interestingly enough, it's attacks on the Stone of Tyr and then attacks between two different factions of enemies. If I'm remembering correctly, it was Thorne, help me out here. How did we segment all was attacking who?
Samael attacked the Stone of Tyr, and then Semirog sent her followers into the stone to fight against Samael's forces.
So see, right there, she told you from the beginning that the Forsaken, that they're, you know.
And at the same time, Lanfear is approaching Rand too. So
right. There's
three different sides in this conflict here, right at the beginning. And that's really, just between the Forsaken.
Right. It's basically the Forsaken just kind of converge on the fortress after, you know, Rand seizes Kalimdor, which in my opinion was probably the worst time to descend upon the Stone of Tyr, because Rand shows up, you know, he's in the Stone of Tyr, there's all this fighting going on between the different Trollocs and Dark Friends all through there, and he basically takes Kalimdor and creates a lightning storm inside of this fortress and just mercilessly wipes out the Trollocs and the Fades. Like, it was that moment. Yes. That's when that's Rand, right. You talking about with the girl?
Yes, when Rand tries to revive the little girl. That's such an upsetting scene.
So, and that really captures, though, because, you know, Rand's mindset for the longest time, you know, first book is, I don't know what's going on. Second book is, I really don't think I'm the Dragon Reborn. Third book is, I'm the Dragon Reborn. What do I do now? And then fourth book is, I'm the Dragon Reborn. Deal with it. Is basically where that's kind of, so he, in this, you know, experiencing all this power flowing through him, especially with Kalendor, which I don't think many people need to be reminded is a extremely powerful Sangreal. He is doing all this stuff. He's killing all these Trollocs and Fays with the lightning storm that he generates. And it's a very, very sobering moment. He looks at the people that have died and he sees a girl. It was a young girl that had been killed, probably run through. I think she had been run through by a Trolloc or something. She had a hole in her chest, because that's very important detail. And then he's trying to use Sidine to bring her back to life. And the whole time, Moraine knows what he's trying to do, and she's saying, Rand, stop. You can't do this. This is for the Creator only. You have to stop. You have to stop. And he's like, what? I'm the Dragon Reborn. I can do what I want. Why can't I make her live? So he tries, and the corpse actually animates somewhat. She actually gets picked up off the floor, but
I think it's more like he was like controlling her body, like a limp
puppet, basically.
Yes, it's kind of terrifying.
Well, the most terrifying part for me was what I was building to was he tries to use the one power to make her heart start beating. And he's actually compressing her heart and making it beat, but the blood's actually just flowing out of her wounds. So it's this really ghastly scene, and it really shows really quickly that even the great Dragon Reborn, this extremely powerful channeler, you know, the one that's supposed to fulfill all these prophecies, even he has limitations. And right out of the gate, there's one right there, and it shows what happens when you mess with things you shouldn't be messing with, even if you have that much power flowing through you.
Yeah.
But after all that, the company kind of splits. And I was actually commenting to Thorne about this before we actually started. This is the first book, in my opinion, where we get like actual multiple storylines. We get about four main storylines in this book. I mean, we get other, you know, plot lines and stuff in the other three, but most of it still kind of centers around the same people, and it's just different points of view within that art. But in The Shadow Rising, we have four different groups, or four different plot threads that we have to follow, and we're going to kind of go over each one of those in detail here in a few minutes. But basically what ends up happening is Rand, kind of centering around Rand, after all of that stuff with the Stone of Tyr, he leaves for the Aiel Waste, and Egwene and Moraine decide to go with him. Now,
Matt also went with him.
Right, but he wasn't going to go at first. And then...
He had to.
Well, he talked to the good old Elfin. And
the Elfin.
But it says Elfin here.
Oh, wait. Oh, yeah,
Which is it, Elfin or Elfin? Come on, people. Vote now on your phone.
I should know what the Elfin are because I run an Elfin page. But I got confused.
That's not good. That's not good. Don't get confused.
He doesn't talk to the Elfin until later.
Right. And that's what I was trying to remember is he talked to one of them in the Stone of Tyr, and then if I remember right, he talked to the other later on in Ruidon, which we're going to talk about.
He talked to the Elfin in Tyr because Elfin answer questions.
Yeah, that's right. So they answered his question. So he basically asked a question of, I'm trying to remember the exact question he asked, but through the questions, he was counseled by the Elfin Tarangreal to go with Rand, to go into the Waste with Rand. So reluctantly, and this is kind of a theme with Matt, reluctantly he accompanies Rand and goes into the Aiel Waste. Meanwhile, good old Perrin Ebarra decides he's going to go back to the Two Rivers because he starts hearing of some things going on around the Two Rivers, and his heart hasn't quite, you know, separated from the Two Rivers in the way Rand and Matt has. He's still very much even in the mindset of being, you know, wanting to be in the Two Rivers. So he goes back to the Two Rivers, and he is accompanied by Faile. So they go back there to try to take care of things in the Two Rivers. And then a third group is Elaine and Nynaeve and Tom. They all leave to go to Terrabon to hunt Black Aja. So we still have the Black Aja hunt going on. You know, it really got kicked off a little bit in the Great Hunt, and then now it's really coming into full swing here in this book. And then the fourth main storyline is we see Min Farshaw. She arrives in Tarvalen, and she's reporting to the Armelin. She's reporting to Swan Sanche, and there's a lot of things surrounding her visions and some happenings there that I was, again, commenting to Thorn earlier that really sets up. It's not so much a huge deal in this book so much as it sets things up that are to come, which we won't spoil any of that for this episode. But the Shadow Rising in all has four different groups of characters for four different plot lines. So I think the first plot line we're going to dive into is actually one of my favorite plot lines in the whole series, and that is Rand and his company going into the Iyo Waste.
Yes.
So Thor, why don't you tell us a little bit about that? Let's get that conversation going.
So Rand transports everybody who's going with him, Matt, Egwene, and Moraine, and all of the Aiel at the Stone of Tyr to the Aiel Waste, where the Tardad and Shido Aiel are waiting for them. So this is where we get to really know Avienda, who was a Maiden of the Spear, and she is going to become a Wise One.
And see, that was something that always interested me, was the way they did their culture. The way their culture was. We'll talk a little bit more about that, but I just always loved how Avienda was like, I don't want to be a leader, I just want to kill things. So I always thought that was that was funny, especially in this book, because you really see it fleshed out in this book, and then you see her grow into other things later on. But there's definitely a lot of tension, somewhat comical tension, with Avienda in this book for sure.
Yes, so we've got Moraine, Avienda, Matt, and Rand all entering Ruidian, which is like a sacred place for the Aiel. All three of them, they all four enter a Tarangriel in Ruidian.
Well, mine says three because they basically entered in three groups. Moraine went alone, Avienda went alone, and then Matt and Rand kind of went at the same time. Even though they went different directions, they still went at the same time. So maybe that's what that meant.
Or maybe it's just talking about, because technically the door frame is also a Tarangriel.
Mm-hmm. The columns.
And Moraine and Avienda went through a Tarangriel, and so did Rand. So that should be four.
Well, in any case,
but,
they all went in there.
Rand relives portions of the lives of his paternal ancestors before and after the breaking, and learn that the Aiel once shunned violence and served Aes Sedai, which actually they used to follow this thing called the Way of the Leaf, mm-hmm. which is what the Tuathon
Tinkers.
I said Tuathon, right? but they used to basically be pacifists.
Right. And this is a huge deal. That's a huge deal.
Yeah, that is a big thing, because the Aiel fight all the time, and they kind of shun the Tuathon because they think that the Tuathon are weak and unable to do things because they don't fight.
This part that It's actually this part where Rand learns these things. You know, he goes through the Terangreal. He starts having these different visions, and he has a few. It's not just one vision where he sees everything. It's like it's not just a typical vision where it's like you're watching everything play out on a TV screen. He, in the visions, becomes somebody associated with the events he's witnessing, somebody who's participating actively in the events that he's witnessing, which I thought was a very cool way to bring this information out. I thought this was one of the more genius things that Jordan put in his books.
I think my favorite one is the one where he actually sees the birth of the Maidens of the Spear. Because the woman wants to go rescue her child.
Right.
And she takes up a spear and they ask her, what about your husband? And she says, this is my husband now.
I did like that
part. And that was one of the more intense ones that I really loved. And I really loved watching that because I can't blame her. Like, I'd do anything for my daughter. I'm not going to sit back if she's in danger.
And I think that, I think that's a good point, you know, because the whole thing that Rand goes through is he's basically witnessing the history of the Aiel through the eyes, as you've already stated, of his paternal ancestors, because, you know, Tamil Thor, of course, was not Randall Thor's blood father, his biological father. His biological father was Aiel. So when he's in Rhuridian, he actually is going back through his family line all the way back to the Breaking. And then we get some snippets of what happened around the Breaking, and we see all kinds of stuff.
I think it's before the Breaking, too.
I was always confused about that because I feel like when it starts, I feel like it's either during or after because of what they were told to do.
Well, there's a part early on where there's the memories of people like singing and planting trees with the Ogier. And that would be well before the Breaking.
That's a good point. And even still, it goes that far back though. And that's still, because I don't know about anybody else listening or you, Thorn, or anyone, but I'm a sucker for backstory. Like if I have a lot of questions and Wheel of Time just completely satisfies that itch, you know, because you'll be reading and you hear all these different things and it satisfies it in a lot of different ways. And in some ways it doesn't. And I don't want to say what it doesn't for fear of giving away things, beyond Shadow Rising. But to speak to Shadow Rising, you know, the first few books, you know, you're reading about the Aiel, you meet the Aiel, and you're like, oh, who are these people? And then the Aiel start talking about this sin that they committed, this reason why they had to go to what they call, everyone else calls it the Waste, they call it the Threefold Land. And they had to go into the Threefold Land as a type of, I feel like it's almost a self-imposed exile of sorts.
Like a punishment. Mm-hmm.
And as a penance, as an eternal penance for what they did. But the whole question is, what did they do? And guess what, everyone? And if you know, spoiler, you find out in this book. And it's pretty incredible. If that's the right word to use.
Yeah. But as tinkers, they would collect Angreal, Songreal, and Terangreal to take to Rhuidian. And whenever Rand comes out, he has dragons marking both of his arms. And usually whenever a chief goes into the Terangreal, when he comes out, he has one dragon marking one arm. But whenever Rand comes out, he has a dragon on each arm,
right?
Which proves that he's the Karakarn, which is the Aiel's chief of chiefs, and not just a regular chief.
And this is a pretty, you know, pretty pivotal moment because what?
Also, it's.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was going to talk about one of the prophecies of the dragon.
Oh, that's where I was headed. So have at it.
So there's the prophecy that talks about him being marked twice by the heron, which he's already had. And then it said he's supposed to be marked twice by the dragon. So this is where that comes to fruition. I don't have the exact.
I'm trying to pull it up right now. It's which interestingly enough, many people out there know of. I think it's Discord. I know we've talked about it on our Discord, but there is a metal band, Blind Guardian, that has the Wheel of Time song, which is literally from Rand's viewpoint, and there is a section that sings part of the Koreathon cycle, which is actually the part I'm about to read right now. If you give me just a second. Yeah, so it says, twice and twice shall he be marked, twice to live and twice to die. Once the heron to set his path, twice the heron to name him true. Once the dragon for remembrance lost, twice the dragon for the price he must pay. So he's already been marked once, twice for the heron. Now it's once, twice, dragon. So we've already covered the heron bit because that happened in the Great Hunt. And then now here we are in the Shadow Rising, and he is being marked with these, they're essentially dragon tattoos, you know, but
that actually makes once the dragon for remembrance lost is him finding out the memories of his ancestors.
Right.
So that suddenly makes a lot of sense.
And see, part of me has to wonder, like, what order Jordan wrote this stuff in. Like, did he basically map out the things that Rand would do as Dragon Reborn and then come back behind it and come up with the prophecies to fit that? Or did he sit down and write these prophecies out first and then actually write the events? Like, I'm interested to know that. That we will, unless we, you know, it's in his notes somehow, but you know, in what order he came up with this. Like, did he just start jotting down stuff and he's coming up with all these prophecies and then he wrote about the events to fit the prophecies, or did he do it the other way around? Because when you sit down and you read through these prophecies, I mean, everything happens in the books throughout the whole series. Everything happens. He fulfills them all. He's definitely the Dragon Reborn. And I find that kind of thing interesting. And it's one of the things that really, really endeared me to the series, is all these prophecies. I'm a sucker for that kind of thing, especially in fantasy literature.
Yes.
But you're talking about the remembrance lost. I think one thing I really want to drill down on right now, you know, if you want to discuss it, Thorne, is what Rand discovered about the Aiel specifically, because we already mentioned that the big reveal is that this warrior culture used to be pacifists, and that this is such a huge truth, a huge revelation, that's actually the test of a chief, is if you go through and you find out this knowledge and it doesn't shatter you, it doesn't break your morale and your will to keep going and be Aiel, then you're fit to be a chief, basically.
Yeah.
Is kind of how this all plays out. But before that, though, we kind of find out what the sin of the Aiel were, the very thing that drove the Aiel into the Threefold Land and the thing that actually pushed them into becoming this warrior culture. So Thorne, why don't you talk to us a little bit about what that sin was?
I can't remember. I think it was picking up weapons, wasn't it?
Well, it was. So in one of the original visions, if I'm remembering everything correctly, one of the first visions that Rand has, it's the Aes Sedai giving the Aiel a commission to go and basically what the Aes Sedai wanted the Jyn Aiel to do, which is what they were called before they split between who became the Tinkers and who became the Aiel. What the Aes Sedai wanted them to do was they were giving them a bunch of artifacts, mainly Angrial, Sangrial, some Terangrial, you know, and giving a bunch to them for safekeeping. And this is, I think this is the vision I had in my head earlier when I was talking about, you know, things happening during the breaking. The Aes Sedai commissioned the Jinnaeil to protect these things and not to give them up to anyone, to hang on to them with their lives, and to, you know, to keep them safe. And they failed to do that ultimately. And they were so broken by this failure that it ended up driving them to basically re-identify themselves and move into the Aiel Waste. I mean, there's some other things that happened that pushed that, some other events, but basically that right there really messed with their identity as a people. And then we see the progression of the people that will eventually become known as the Aiel. I'm trying to make sure that I'm recounting all of that right. But it was a pretty big reveal, especially because it led to the Aiel, you know, coming away from pacifism to, you know, like I said, a warrior culture. And when you discover that in Rydion, I'll put it to you like this. I listened to all of it and I thought I heard something wrong. And I literally restarted from the beginning of the visions, because the visions happen over a few different chapters.
Yeah.
I literally went all the way back, because I basically listened to all of them already. I went all the way back and listened to all of it again to make sure I caught it right. And I did. I caught it right. Is there anything else you're remembering about that, Thorn?
No, not really. The biggest thing that I remember from it is that they slowly basically became warriors because the Jinnaeil were being attacked, and then you had these other Aiel who weren't willing to stay pacifist, who were like protecting them from afar.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the birth of the maidens, whenever the one woman's child gets kidnapped. And she decides to marry her spear as such. I really can't remember.
Yeah, that was actually the point of view you're talking about there with the first maiden of the spear. I actually have that chapter pulled up right now. I'm looking at the different things here. So it was basically, let's see here. So Rand's point of view that he's seeing through the eyes of a man named Jeordam, 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 I guess is how you say that. But through this man's eyes, he sees five different people, and they're kind of coming through the snow. They're in snow toward him. There's three cloaked men and two women in bulky dresses. So he pulls his veil down and kind of stands up and reveals himself, and it's to his understanding, it's the Jinnaeil, and he asked them if they need help. Well, one of them kind of gets mad at being called a Jinn, asserting that it's true that as the Aiel have given up the way, which means they've given up the pacifism. So Rand's ancestor says that that's a lie because he's never held a sword. So right here, we're seeing that split. You know, there's already people who have taken off and they've decided to go after the way of the spear, not the way of the leaf, as it were.
Yeah, and the technicality is that their way believed that, I think it was meant for all weapons, but it specifically said swords. So mm-hmm. by taking up a spear, they weren't technically breaking any rules.
Right. They were basically exploiting a technicality. Like, we can protect ourselves as long as we don't use swords. We can use spears and shields, and we can fight that way, but we cannot use a sword. Whereas those who follow the way of the leaf said no weapons whatsoever. And what's interesting to me, and we'll get to this a little bit when we speak about everything that happened in the Two Rivers, is, you know, the tinkers in the Two Rivers and how the way of the leaf is being viewed by people in the Two Rivers during all of that stuff going on, and what eventually happens with some of those characters. It's just interesting to me that in two of the four major plot lines, you're dealing with tinkers in some way. You're dealing with the way of the leaf in some way, and whether it is a true way to follow or it's something that's not worth following, and we see people abandon it. We see people follow it. It's really interesting, and this is actually, to my recollection in the series, this is the most information we get about what the Way of the Leaf is, who used to follow it, who still follows it, and so on and so forth. But Rand goes through all these visions, and he sees all these different things, and he goes through the process to become a chief, and when he emerges out of Ruidon, or Ruidian, however you want to say it, when he comes out of the mountain, like, he actually comes out of the side of the mountain, and he's, I believe it was right at dawn, and I'm setting something up here.
What the he who comes with the dawn thing was, is that at the time, whenever he and Matt leave, he runs up, and as they are coming up out of Ruidian, it's dawn.
Yeah, that's where I was headed with that. That's exactly what, and that was just another interesting way that the, I guess you could say, the prophecy was fulfilled. Because that's another thing that's interesting, is that all throughout these books, and I'm just going to try to address what's at the Shadow Rising up to this point. All throughout these books, you see these different cultures have different prophecies of the dragon. And yes, one of the things that Rand has to fulfill is, you know, they call him the Kar Karn, which means Chief of Chiefs, but they also call him He Who Comes with the Dawn. And we knew this going into Ruidian. You know, we knew about that fact. We knew what they called the Kar Karn. We knew his names. We knew basically, because what's so funny to me is, you know, Moraine and everyone from, you know, the other side of the mountains, you know, is calling Rand the dragon. And they're like, well, we don't know this dragon, but we seek the Kar Karn. We seek He Who Comes with the Dawn. We seek that guy. And yeah, it seems like there's some time has to pass before the Aiel finally realize, oh, they just call him the dragon. We call him the Kar Karn. It's not two different people. But until Rand was revealed as the Kar Karn, they were two different people. It's like, you can be the dragon all you want. We need you to be the Kar Karn. Are you the Kar Karn? And so when he comes out of Ruidian, he's got both the dragons on his arms, which is in, I believe, the Aiel prophecies and the Kariathon cycle, which we know is in the Kariathon cycle. We just read it. But he comes out, and he's got both of these things on his arms.
Yes. Like I said before, normally a regular chief of the Aiel would only have a dragon marking one arm. But Rand had it marking both arms.
Right. So that basically marks him chief of chiefs in a way. It's basically saying it without saying it. So that's a pretty pivotal moment, and it's one of my, you know, that whole sequence in Ruidian is like one of my favorite out of the entire series, because Rand really starts having to deal with what the weight of being the Dragon Reborn is, not just to the people across the mountains, but to these people, which I feel like after his time in the Waste in the Shadow Rising, I feel like that kind of puts the Aiel in a really special place in Rand's heart and life for the rest of the series. And that's barring anything that happens with Avienda. I mean, that place that they have in his life almost has disastrous consequences way later. And I'm not going to get into all that, but all that stuff about Rand aside, Thorn, what did Matt get into? This is some really interesting stuff.
My boy, Matt. So he goes into Ruidian, and he sees a Turangreal that looks just like the one that he had encountered in Tyr. Well, so he goes, of course, being Matt, and he's like, I'm going in there.
He's like, yep, gotta go.
But instead of encountering the snake-like elfin, he encounters a more fox-like eelfin. And they bargain for gifts instead of answering questions. And Matt does not know this. So he just goes in asking questions. And in this, he also speculates later that the two factions, the snake-like elfin and the fox-like eelfin, are the namesake for the children's game Snakes and Foxes, which is a game that cannot be won without cheating.
One thing that's always messed me up about the two different names, Elfin and Eelfin, is that I always want to put Eelfin with snakes because the first three letters are E-E-L, like eel. So like eel is like a weird looking snake. So it's like, oh, Eelfin. It's like, no, Elfin. I'm like, but wait a minute, Jordan, you missed gold here, man. Like, hold on. And so it always confused me, and I'd have to, whenever someone would mention it in the books, I would kind of wait for a description or some kind of context. So I'd know, oh, okay, I could picture foxes or snakes in my head. Not, you know, because obviously Eelfin is the opposite of what you think. They are not the snakes. They are the foxes. And it's the Eelfin, which really doesn't relate to either foxes or snakes in any kind of way. But it's the Eelfin that are the snakes. So I still have trouble separating those out. So when I saw we were talking about that too, I was just like, you run that account, Thorne. You have that. Go ahead. You know the differences.
Oh, yeah. I pretend to know the differences.
That's what we're all doing here, kids. We are pretending to know things when we're just reading stuff. Anyway.
So what I'm trying to find right now is what exactly Matt asked for. I'm having trouble finding it.
I might be able to help you with that. Let me see real quick. Ladies and gentlemen, in case you didn't know, we actually keep a ton of, well, I keep a ton of windows open on my computer while we're talking about all these things because of things just like this. Definitely want to be a little more prepared, but these are actually very specific things that we don't ever know if we're actually going to talk about. I was stalling for you. It was not a competition. I was stalling for you. So now that I've done my job, do yours.
So during his, he thinks that the Eelfin are the same as the Elfin, and he starts asking questions, and he's starting to get frustrated. And in the process, he accidentally makes three wishes. His wishes are to have the holes in his memory filled, to be free from the One Power and Aes Sedai, and to be away from the Eelfin and return to Ruidian if they would not answer his questions. So what the Eelfin gave him was a spear called an Ashendari, fluency in the old tongue and the memory of his own ancestors, and a medallion Turangriel that protects against the One Power. And whenever he comes out of this, Rand is the one who finds him as he's coming out of the Turangriel, and he finds Matt hanging from the Tree of Life. They had the Ashendari hung between branches on the Tree of Life and was hanging Matt from it. But Rand managed to do CPR on Matt because apparently Master Luhan knows CPR and he saw it done once.
I saw this thing that one time. I think it works. Please work. Oh, please work.
It worked, though.
It's breathing. It works. Yay, I did a thing.
And so after that, Matt starts wearing a scarf around his neck to hide the scars. And, but yeah, Matt's adventures in Elfin and Eelfin land.
Well, it's just, it like any other book in the series, especially at this first half, and maybe this is a little closer to the first quarter of the series, you know, there's a lot of things happening now that set up big things to happen later, which I won't mention. But I always found it kind of ironic that he's hanged and left for dead from something called the Tree of Life.
That's kind of ironic.
I mean, it's probably the point. I'm sure when Jordan wrote that, he was just like, let's see how many people catch this. And it's the Tree of Life and Matt's dead. So, haha. But that was the price he had to pay for the things that the Eelfin gave him. And dude didn't know. He didn't know anything about either of these guys. He comes out of the series later. This isn't really a spoiler. It's just kind of an FYI. He comes out of the series later by the end of it all, knowing way too much about both of them. So, but this is kind of the beginning of his dealings with them. And he had no clue. He was just like, oh, these are just like the guys I talked to in Stone of Tear, but they're not snakes. They're foxes. I like foxes. Okay, whatever. Maybe they'll be nice to me. No, they hung him from a tree.
What the Eelfin says is that he did not set an agreement for the bargain.
Mm-hmm.
So with the Eelfin, they just answer questions, and there's not really a deal to be made. They just answer three questions.
Which is why Matt did not do that.
But with the Eelfin, they have bargains. It's not just they give you things. You have to make a deal with them.
So which is deal, man.
And because Matt did not set terms for what he wanted, the Eelfin did what they wanted, and they hung him from a tree.
And the stories he tells about this later on is always he has his Matt way of speaking about it. But that's like I said, the Shadow Rising really is a turning point for more than just Rand. It's a turning point for all three Ta'veren. You know, we see things happen in this book that shape really everyone, not just Matt, Rand, and Perrin, but, you know, everyone connected to them, all the main characters that we've seen. There's some things happen in this book that really, if you'll excuse the slight pun off of the Kreathon cycle, really set their path, so to speak. For Rand, it's kind of literal, but for Matt and Perrin and a lot of the others, it's very much, you know, there's some things that happen that ultimately either come back around later, whether to haunt them or to help them. It really puts them on a trajectory that they stay on pretty much the rest of the series. So I think that's why the Shadow Rising, like I said at the beginning of the episode, Shadow Rising and Towers of Midnight are basically my two favorites. Like they kind of swap places depending on the mood I'm in and what I'm talking about. Because right now I'm really feeling Shadow Rising because that's what we're talking about. But man, Towers of Midnight is so good. But I'm sitting here thinking about it, and without really spoiling anything, because obviously it's one of the last books, so this what I'm about to say is going to make sense. A lot of the arcs and things that begin here, especially, kind of come to fruition either in or by Towers of Midnight. And when we get to discussing that, and if you've gotten to that book, there's some very huge things that happen in that book. Huge, 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 huge things that happen in that book. And when I'm sitting there reading it, you know, I read it just a couple of months ago. While I was sitting there reading it, my mind kept going back to the Shadow Rising and everything that started in the Shadow Rising. Because a lot of things that happen in the Shadow Rising come back around to fruition, completion, in the Towers of Midnight. So that's kind of Matt's deal. Thorne didn't. What about Moraine? Moraine went too. What was she up to during all this?
At this point in the story, we don't really know much about what Moraine was doing. All we know is that she visited a three-hoop Turangreal that's used by the Wise Ones, and it gives her some knowledge of the future. It's not exact. What it is basically she's given knowledge about what could happen if she makes certain decisions. But it's not like... it's not like she has all these memories of different lives she could live. It's whenever she gets to a certain point, she can be like, oh, if I do the wrong thing here, then it could result in something bad. Type of thing to help her kind of make the right decisions when the time comes.
And that really kind of cements everything I just said about the characters getting on a certain trajectory in this book. Like it happened to Moraine too. It happens to all of them, really.
Moraine really only had one choice.
Mm-hmm.
After seeing all of her possible futures. So
she pulled a Doctor Strange in Infinity War.
Yeah, pretty much. But yeah, that's all I have for Moraine.
Well, and we didn't get any Moraine. Her presence in the Shadow Rising was largely counsel to Rand. You know, trying to, you know, get Rand to do certain things, observe certain things, and kind of become the Dragon Reborn. That's her. That was her whole shtick. Was I'm gonna find the Dragon Reborn and make sure he does what he's supposed to. But the, like I said, there is that whole path setting thing in Rhydian that, you know, these things come up in later books. And again, I can't say too much about that right now, but they are going to come back around. Now, what I always found a part of this whole arc in the Waste that I always found humorous was that the wise ones decide. Well, when they get back to the Waste, the wise ones tell Avienda, you're going to become a wise one. You're not going to be a maiden of the spear anymore. You're going to become a wise one. You're going to start learning the ways of the wise ones. She's been running from it, and now it's time for her to you know, step up to the plate and be an apprentice and start learning the ways of the wise ones so she can, you know, she can become one. Well, they assign her the task of teaching Rand, the prospective Kara Karn, or at this point, I think when they assign her to him, he's got both the dragons on his arms. They assign her the task of teaching Rand all the IO customs because he's left and right offending everybody. he doesn't know anything about anything. And
okay, all the way up to the end, he offends the IO.
yes. Even with Avienda, especially with Avienda there. Like
Rand never gets the IEL.
I think he gets them better by the end of the Shadow Rising and through some of the next couple of books, but
not very well though.
Not as well as he could have. It was because always
you've got Egwene who's learning from the wise ones, and she just goes full on into it, and she pretty much becomes IEL.
Which, oh wait. Did Greg make a good point? Greg made a good point because that's something else that comes up later for Egwene. Like I said, Shadow Rising, pivotal book.
It is very pivotal. It's very important for Egwene's training with the Aiel and just her. I think that one of Egwene's strongest points is that she throws herself into everything that she does.
It's a strength and a weakness, I think.
It can be a weakness, but it's very useful for her because she doesn't half-ass anything.
Right.
When she trained with the wise ones, she wasn't just going to pretend to be a wise one. She was going to as they said. Yes, she was going to train as one, and if she wanted to, she could have probably stayed.
Well, they wanted her to. They didn't want her to go back with Aes Sedai. And what I actually find funny, too, about things that begin to... So we've talked a lot about things that begin to build up, you know, build up and begin in the Shadow Rising. But some things that begin to unravel, starting in the Shadow Rising, is the relationship between the Aiel Wise Ones and the Aes Sedai. Because when they first got there, when Moraine and all of them first got there, they were... Aes Sedai were super revered, in which, I mean, if you go through the visions that Rand had of the Aiel history, you know, you see that part of that reverence comes from, oh, we failed the Aes Sedai, so we're forever in their debt, so we need to listen to them and do what they say, and Aes Sedai are great, Aes Sedai are the best, Aes Sedai, we love you, you know. And then starting in the Shadow Rising and kind of moving on from there, they just kind of start... Basically, the picture I always got of the Wise Ones in dealing with Aes Sedai from Shadow Rising forward is they just kind of look at each other and scratch their heads and going, "These are the great Aes Sedai that we've been revering all these years." What?
Yeah.
Like they're chumps. Like we know better than this. And I love that about the Wise Ones is that they do not take your crap. They don't.
No.
Like Moraine tries to give them Aes Sedai words, and basically she gets called out. She gets called out by all of them. They say, don't give us those words. Tell us what you're doing here. Tell us what you want. Tell us what's going on. Tell us, who is this man you brought us? Like, what are you doing? Just because you're an Aes Sedai doesn't mean you get to pull the wool over our eyes, okay? Yeah, we're in debt to you. We failed you, but you know what? That doesn't mean you get to treat us this way. So the wise ones very much don't put up with any kind of Aes Sedai BS at all. But something else, kind of switching gears a little bit, something else pretty pivotal in Rand's development occurs right after he comes out of Viridian, and that is basically having to actually prove, even with the stuff on his arms and everything, he still has to prove that he is supposed to be the Kara Karn, and he has to go to it's Coldrock's Hold to basically present himself to all of the clan chiefs and those who would basically judge and weigh if he is the really is the Kara Karn or not. And some pretty substantial drama occurs when they get there.
This is where Matt gets his hat too.
Yes, it is. It is. Very much is.
Yes, because on their way to Coldrock's Hold, they end up meeting up with some merchants who travel with them. And this is whenever Matt sees a hat and he's like, I like that hat. How much would you sell it to me for? And that becomes a Matt staple of the entire books, is his hat that he loves so much.
And see, that's why, because I have the copies of the books I have are the newer paperbacks, the ones that have the different artwork for each one. It's from a different artist. So it's not like the Daryl Sweet art. It's the different, you know, different ones, which in my opinion, some of those covers are better than the original covers, especially because there's a couple of them are just pretty epic that I can't describe on this episode, but they're pretty cool. But the one for the Shadow Rising is Matt in front of the Tree of Life with the Ashandarai draped across his shoulders, and he's just kind of standing there all smug. But notably missing for anyone who's read the books up to, you know, past this point, anyone who's looking at the artwork, is his hat. He does not have his hat in this art. It's not there because it was just before he got his hat. But yes, again, Shadow Rising. Come on, guys. I'm making a case here for it being the best book. I'm just going to go ahead and say it's the best book because so many important things happen in this book. Matt gets his hat, y'all. Matt gets his hat. If anything else should convince you that The Shadow Rising is the best book in the Wheel of Time, it's because Matt Bloody Coffin gets his flaming hat. That should convince you. I'm done. The rest of the show is yours, Thorn. Mic drop. I'm out.
Okay. So at Alcair Dal, Rand and Cooladin of the Shido Aiel both declare themselves as he who comes with the dawn. Cooladin's claiming that he's actually he who comes with the dawn and is also showing with tattoos that are similar to Rand's. But he was never given permission to go into Ruidian. That's a pretty big deal. So to prove that he really is the Kara Karn, Rand reveals the secret history of the Aiel, to everyone. And, the Aiel people are freaking out because only wise ones and clan chiefs know about the secret history. And so they freak out. And to stop violence, to stop anything from happening, Rand actually uses the One Power to cause a rainstorm in the waste. So it is a rainstorm in the middle of the desert.
Which is like, bro, how did you do that? What? Like, they freak out. I want to touch a little bit on, you know, because you mentioned that Rand basically had to reveal the true history of the Aiel in order to kind of prove that he is the Karakarn, that he went through everything. One thing we did glance over was when Rand went in there, he went in there after, not to get, but sequentially after Culloden's brother, who was going in there to become the clan chief. And so he didn't come back out. So basically he's Culloden's trying to step up and say, well, I should be clan chief. But again, there's the there is the contention of, well, you didn't go through Ruidian. But
and you never to be able to go into Ruidian, they have to have permission from the wise ones. And I think it's three or four of them have to agree, have to say yes. And they all said no to Culloden.
So basically this dude, even with the two different dragons on his arms, he's already fighting an uphill battle to be accepted, even as a clan and a chief of his own clan, much less the Karakarn, which I always wondered about that, like how he got off making such bold claims when he couldn't even become legitimately become the chief of his own clan, of his own group of Aiel. Like I really never understood, I guess, understood that. Not why Jordan wrote that, but why, what made Culloden think he could get, basically, I won't say get away with it, but basically become even the Karakarn, because he couldn't even become a regular chief.
Although a lot of Aiel end up following Culloden, because they assume that because Culloden was raised Aiel, that he had to be the real Karakarn. And this whole revelation thing screws up the Aiel.
It messes with them pretty bad. And I was trying to, I think I've got it pulled up now. So talking about the Aiel prophecy, which comes into play with this event. You know, one of the things, so we talked about how one of the prophecies, you know, the prophecies call him He Who Comes with the Dawn. So that's his name. But the another part of the prophecy says, let's see if I've got it up right here. It says, let's see, the stone that never falls will fall to announce his coming. Of the blood, but not raised by the blood, he will come from Ruidian at dawn and tie you together with bonds you cannot break. He will take you back and he will destroy you. That last part starts here at Cold Rock's Hold. Because what ends up happening, as you know, is like you just mentioned it. Some decide they're going to follow Culloden. And they decide they're going to follow Culloden because they can't trust a Wetlander. He's not one of us. At least Culloden's one of us. You know, who is this, you know, soft Wetlander that's come to try to take the Aiel? He's no Karakarn, you know, all this other stuff. Whereas all the wise ones, or the majority of the wise ones, are thinking about these prophecies and they're going, well, that's understandable. But at the same time, he's of the blood, but he's not raised by the blood. He just came out of Ruidian at dawn. I mean, and then look, he shared the secret knowledge, and things are starting to unravel. And then he went.
He actually knows the knowledge. So yeah. After there's fighting among the Aiel, and then Rand ends up pursuing Asmodian, one of the Forsaken, who is
he's
arguably
I saw something the other day that had different nicknames for Forsaken. I think his was like Harp Boy or something like that, like because he plays a harp, and he was basically, if I remember correctly, he was in disguise as one of the merchants and was following Rand around, but then everything breaks out.
In disguise as a Gleeman.
Yes, that was right. Which is fitting, as Modian was very flashy.
Yes, he was. So he was actually in search of a Turangriel access key to something called the Choden Call, which is the most powerful Songriel ever created.
Oh, the Choden Call.
So at Ruidian, Rand defeats Osmodian by cutting him off from the Dark One. So he basically sees these like threads coming from Osmodian.
Mm-hmm.
And he slices through them. And so he's no longer connected to the Dark One.
Which is a pretty big power move. I'm just saying.
Lanfear, of course, being obsessed with Luz Theron, allows Rand to live. And she basically shields Osmodian in a way to where he can only channel in trickles. And so Osmodian can teach Rand to use the one power. Because Rand doesn't have a teacher because he's... There's no male channelers in this world.
Unless you count the
Forsaken. So pretty much. What?
Unless you count the Forsaken. Which we have to
right here. Exactly. And when he returns to Al-Kerdal, he finds that most of the Aiel have acknowledged him as the Karakarn.
And it's kind of one of those things where it went from being a pretty, pretty big uphill battle to convince everyone to, again, not everyone really accepts him, but things just kind of fell into place because prophecy, but, you know, things started falling into place. I think, if I remember correctly, Rand was kind of, I want to say surprised, but maybe surprised that it was kind of turning around so quickly, because I think he thought that maybe he had more, he basically had to campaign. You know, basically he was going to have to go see all these different chiefs one-on-one and campaign and try to convince them. But then when after everything happens, they're like, oh, yeah, man, you're the Karakarn. And it wasn't every Aiel chief, but it was the majority to where you could say the Aiel people were rallying behind him.
I think actually all the chiefs admitted that he was the actual Karakarn because he actually knew the prophecies, because the only sept that really broke off from the main force of the Aiel were the Shido, and no clan chiefs went with the Shido. It was all the only people who weren't part of the Shido who went with them were just regular Aiel.
Yeah, there were some Aiel that left their clans to follow the Shido because they would not follow Rand. So maybe that's where I kind of got that messed up.
Yeah.
That does come up a little more later.
All the clan chiefs know that what Rand says is true because they've also seen the history of the Aiel.
And, you know, I have to wonder something, though, because we haven't mentioned one character that's introduced in the Shadow Rising that becomes a pretty, I don't want to say a pretty big deal, but becomes significant, is Culloden's wife, Savannah.
Oh, yes, Savannah, this bitch.
And we don't see a whole lot of her in the Shadow Rising, which is kind of my way alluding to the fact that we're going to see more of her later. But it's kind of implied that she's the one kind of pulling Culloden's strings because they're not really wanting to recognize her as a wise one and let her go through Ruidian. They're not wanting to do the same thing for Culloden. But Savannah, because if you look at the differences between the two personalities, between Savannah and Culloden, Culloden's very much the, you know, I'm going to puff my chest out. I'm going to make everyone submit by, you know, force of will and all this other stuff. I mean, he is like the stereotypical, you know, I'm going to be Aiel, you know, manly man type of guy, you know, with this huge inflated ego. But Savannah is, the best word I have for Savannah is cunning.
She's very cunning.
She's extremely cunning, and I feel like, because this is never explicitly stated, but from the way Jordan wrote the, you know, wrote her in relation to Culloden in The Shadow Rising was basically she was seen but not heard in front of everyone else, but behind the scenes she was the one pulling Culloden's strings. She wanted to be the wife of the Karakarn. She wanted to be, you know, in a position of power. So she tried to make it happen. And I wouldn't be surprised if she, I don't know if she painted the dragons on his arms herself or what, but or what they did to get those things on there, because that's never revealed, is, you know, how two men have these dragons.
I would assume that it's some kind of tattooing.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the only way that I can think of, unless one of the Forsaken somehow has a way to make that.
Which they might. But that's one of the things that ended up kind of blowing up in Culloden's face, because he was like, look, I've got the dragons on my arms. I'm the Karakarn. They're like, you didn't even go through Rydion. How do you even have one dragon? You know, and that casts substantial doubt on him. Of course, I feel like if he didn't say it like this, I feel like his kind of comeback to that was, or could have been, you know, doesn't matter. I got two of them. So it doesn't matter where I got them from. I'm the Karakarn. You can do what I say. And they're like looking at the prophecies, looking at him, looking at Rand, and they go, freaking Wetlander. Fine. And they follow the Wetlander. So, but I think that really about does it for just kind of the major things. There's a lot of other things that happen in the Iyo Waste. You know, Egwene going through Wise One training, which becomes very significant later, is a very awesome part of all of that. Now, we're a bit out of time tonight, but we want to kind of try to cover the next three arcs next week. We're going to get into the Two Rivers and see what Perrin's up to with Faeel and what's going on there. Also going to follow Nynaeve and Elaine and Tom over to Tanchico on the Black Aja hunt, and then probably put a cap on everything at the end of next episode by visiting Min and seeing what's going on at the White Tower. And because all these things are very important, and we kind of want to cover them all, so we'll come back to the other three plots next week. And of course, anything we feel like we missed, we'll try to bring out next week as well.
Yes. So I guess what's left is to advertise.
Guys, bear with us because we're not good at this.
I'm really bad at closing. and spoiler warnings too.
Yes. So next week, if you want to hear another spoiler warning blooper, please listen to the podcast, because next episode she will be doing the spoiler warning. If you guys haven't figured it out, we're kind of trade duties at the opening. But since you kind of closed it out last week, Thorn, I can try to close it out this week. Best thing to do, if you guys want to keep up with the podcast, is follow us on Twitter at Tower Podcast for the Black Tower Podcast. You can follow Thorn and myself individually on Twitter if you would like. Thorn has at Thorn Fireheart for her handle. I'm the Randall Thor the Dragon Reborn account. That's just type that in. It's easy to find. I feel like I confuse people whenever I share the handle because it's the Dragon Reborn with letter two at the end instead of a couple of letters. But just type in Randall Thor. I'm one of the ones that pop up, and my full name is Randall Thor the Dragon Reborn. So feel free to come follow me there. I'll be acting as Randall Thor, not so much Greg. So, but I'm not really active on my actual Twitter account for me. So don't follow me over there. But feel free to follow us. And of course, if you're not on the Discord, we chat in the Discord every day about all kinds of random stuff, mostly related to Wheel of Time, but we've got some other things we like to discuss in there as well. So come check us out on the Discord. Shoot us a message if you want an invite. All are welcome, so we would definitely want to see you over there on the Discord. But Twitter is the main way to keep up with the podcast and to see any kind of news or anything we've got going on. But Thorn, is there anything else we need to cover before we wrap it up?
I think that's about it.
Okay. Well, we'll just wrap it up. We'll see you guys next time. And for the Black Tower podcast, I'm Greg.
I'm Thorne.
And we'll catch you on the next one.
Bye.
And welcome back to the, God, I read the wrong thing. Well, there's your end of show spoiler, or end of show blooper right there. We both just went in for it. I'm so sorry. For some reason, my brain, I saw the green, and I forgot that was, it's been a long day. Aaron, do whatever you want to with this part. Okay, Thorne, I follow your lead.